Spirit Radio Podcasts.
On the line with me now, I have Niamh Daly, Communications Manager with Tear Fund Ireland, for an update on some of the work that they are doing and connected to. Niamh, thanks for joining us on the programme.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity, Wendy.
You know, when we chat and I think about the work that Tear Fund does, and many people listening will think of their own pandemic challenges, which when you hear about what's going on in countries like Lebanon, they pale in comparison. Give us an update on what's happening, especially in the refugee camps in Lebanon.
Yeah, so I suppose with a country like Lebanon, it's maybe a little bit easier for us to connect in with what's going on because, you know, there's lots of people who've been connected with Lebanon over the years. And in fact, like, we've brought church leaders across to visit some of our partners on the ground over there. So there is some nice connection between Lebanon and Ireland. And, you know, the population isn't that much bigger than ours, just 6.7 million. But of that population, there's about 1.5 million that are refugees, and they're really the ones who are suffering the most in this pandemic. So after Christmas, they had a huge spike in cases, and they went into a very severe lockdown, with even supermarkets being closed and only deliveries by online and could be made by the supermarket. So obviously, this really worked against refugees who'd be living in very makeshift accommodation with postal codes or addresses. So,
and living in close quarters, Niamh, I'd imagine, as well, with lots of...
Yeah, like whole families, yeah. You know, two groups of families. I've got one situation with two sisters living with, you know, toddlers, and, you know, there's about 11 of them in kind of a two-roomed makeshift tent. So, you know, they're really, really on top of each other. And they do think this spike has peaked now, but they are up to like 3,000 cases a day. So when you think of our own numbers, you know, they really are still up there in a very highly infected community of for COVID. So
and what about, Niamh, then, what we know about any sort of vaccination programs? Because I know there's been discussion with the COVAX protocol to try and make sure that countries that mightn't have the same political or economic willpower will have access to them. Will Lebanon?
Well, last time I looked, they were due a delivery of the Pfizer-BioNTech this month, and they had ordered enough that would cover only 15% of their population. And that's really to do with the cost of being able to, you know, seek more of it. And they also hope to get another 20% of the population covered through that COVAX scheme that you mentioned. So, so really, it's firepower at the moment around the vaccines, and you know, there really is concerns over how that even that 15 and 20% will be distributed. Our partners on the ground tell us that at the moment, you know, that local parties are saying that once Lebanon does get its vaccines, that Lebanese people need to prioritise. But obviously, this strategy would fail to protect the most vulnerable, and, you know, would, you know, mitigate against the potential of a further outbreak down the road. So, you know, with this level of community transmission still high, you know, they are very concerned of mutations around the virus, similar to what they've seen from the UK and South Africa. And then access to hospitals, as you can imagine, is just really difficult. You know, public hospitals are overwhelmed, and then for private hospitals, patients have to pay in cash and in advance. So it's really going to, you know, stop any sort of refugees being able to access hospital care. So, yeah, very, very stark situation facing.
And, I mean, just given the picture you've painted there, Niamh, imagining life in a refugee camp without a pandemic is harrowing enough. And then, as you've outlined, just access to vaccines and proper hospital care makes it more complicated. But then also people living in this area, they have weather conditions to contend with as well.
Yeah, that's right. So they had a relatively warm December, but winter hit hard in January and this month as well. And so there's been lots of heavy rains and hailstones, snow. So you may have seen pictures before that we've shared of those tented accommodations in the Bekaa Valley covered with snow and children out, refugees, like, you know, partly clad really in the snow. And so it's a huge struggle to try and keep those places heated. Now, we're really grateful for our partners on the ground, Merit, and they are connected with a number of different church-based organisations, and they've been able to reach out to nearly 10,000 families with some winterisation items that would be indoor stoves and some blankets. So we are really grateful for that work that's continuing on the ground and is really practically helping in this particular season where it's very cold.
Yeah, and that work that's going on the ground is just so important. Tell us a little bit about the Lenten resource that Tear Fund has at the moment.
Yeah, so really, I guess for everybody, it's been such a turmoil, obviously, the last year. And, you know, we've been working very closely with our Tear Fund around the world. It's been a great opportunity, actually, to really connect in with the other Tear Funds. And from Australia have come up with this lovely Lenten resource, really, that really asks the questions around us longing for being back to normal, but was normal really good enough? And, you know, they really see how we've really seen really that the brokenness in our world has really has been hidden in lots of ways, but in this past year has really just become so clear. And, you know, this opportunity we have now for a potential new beginning. So really, it's a Lenten resource that will be rolled out over the 7 weeks of Lent. And if you sign up for it, you get your first one tomorrow and then every week thereafter. And it's really to help us draw kind of deeper to God's promises around restoration and our thinking around what a better world would look like. So we've been really encouraged, actually, with the amount of people who have already signed up and want to receive it. And it just seems to be resonating with people, this idea that to look again at, you know, Jesus's promises that he will make all things new. And what, when does that restoration start? It starts today and every day. So how we can kind of move closer to that and see restoration in our own hearts and lives, in our communities and globally as well.
It's a great resource that people can have access to. And you're busy because you've even more stuff to plan for. What about International Women's Day? Everything will have to be online this March the 8th, but what are you going to do? Have you decided yet, Niamh?
That's right. We are. Watch this piece. We have a lovely event planned for to mark International Women's Day. It'll be inspiring and fun, and we'd love you to come online and be part of that. So we had a great coffee morning there with supporters across the country just before Christmas. And so we kind of want to capture some of the best things about that morning and bring them into a celebration of some really inspiring women around the world who've done great things, and some great inspiring Irish women too. So do come online and we watch the space. We'll tell you more about it as the plan is unveiled.
Great stuff, Niamh. As always, thank you so much for that update. If you want to stay in touch with Tear Fund, indeed connect up with that Lenten resource and or support the work that they do, you can go to their website, tearfund.ie. Spirit. It's midterm break at the moment, even though it might feel a bit strange because obviously children have been homeschooled for such a long time now. It feels like forever. And usually our kids would probably be delighted, but so many kids and parents across the country just want schools to reopen again. And there was an article in the papers today looking at specifically schools in disadvantaged areas have much lower engagement rates, with only about 20% to 50%, depending on the area, being actually able to even connect up with online learning at all. And that's before we even go into that in some DESH schools across the country, this is where children get their bellies filled. And the HSE's own research that was published last week has shown just the long-term impacts that this prolonged stretch outside of school is going to have on children. Well, our next guest, through her work as a journalist and through her own experience as a parent as well, has been chatting to parents about homeschooling and just looking to what should happen next. And a lot of the people she's been chatting to feel schools should be opened as an essential service. On the line to tell us a little bit about what she's been finding, we've journalist with the Irish Independent, Mary McCarthy. Mary, thanks for joining us on the programme.
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us a little bit first, Mary, about your own experience. Have you been homeschooling?
Not very well. Actually, we don't have our midterm until Wednesday, so we're still...
Every school's different, yeah.
We're still battling on for yesterday and today. But, yeah, no, I mean, I would give myself probably 4 out of 10. I'm trying, but, you know, we're tired. Like, the kids are tired, I'm tired. And I think, Wendy, not having an end date, you know, it's like a mom said to me the other day, it's like you're running a marathon and you have no idea when it ends, you know. And so you're feeling kind of fatigued and wrecked, but you don't know when that 26-mile mark is going
yeah,
to...
Yeah, and there's no finish line on it. That's hard for parents like yourself who are juggling work and homeschooling like so many across the country, but also for children who are it's a strange world when they're saying, Mom or Dad, when are we going back to school?
Absolutely. And you know what, it's not really about the parents, although parents, I mean, the reason I'd worry about parents is because when they start not being able to cope, they can't look after their kids. So, you know, that is a worry. But, I mean, the focus here should be the kids. And, you know, I'm lucky. Like, Wendy, don't get me wrong. I'm not sitting here, you know, woe is me. I know how lucky I am because I live in a house where I can work at home. So I'm here, you know, I'm not having to leave the house every day to go and work in a supermarket or food preparation or, you know what I mean? Like, I'm here, so I don't have to be worrying about my kids. But also, like, I have enough to eat. I don't have an alcohol problem. I don't have a drug problem. There's no domestic violence. You know, like, all the odds are working for me. But yes, I would say I'm finding it quite hard. And then if I'm finding it quite hard, like, you know, other people with bigger problems must really.
Yeah, as it's paints the picture, I suppose, Mary, as you say, of even when you have so many things like you've mentioned in your favour, but then when you think of children who are especially vulnerable when they are, and we've seen huge increases of, you know, various different reports and calls being made to different helplines about children being stuck in vulnerable situations. And of course, then the underreporting of these situations, because a lot of the time it's teachers that notice some of these things. But I know you've been speaking to a lot of parents who are in similar situation to you, different situations. Tell us a little bit about some of the conversations you've been having and how others are finding it.
Right, well, this has been really eye-opening, Wendy, because we've had a lot. So I'll just give you a little bit of background. Last week, a few of the parents on my WhatsApp just decided that we had enough and we needed some kind of certainty. So we thought we'd take matters into our own hands, and one of my friends wrote to her TD, Jim Callaghan. So he wrote back straight away and said, look, I'm on it, but, you know, parents need to get more vocal. And until they do, there won't be that pressure on government. And then he kind of dropped a bombshell and says, you know, I'm surprised how quiet you all are. And that just kind of like it was, you know, the kindle to the flames. So initially we were thinking, like, that's, you know, the reason we're quiet is because we're all so
exhausted.
But then, yeah, but then we thought, no, he did us a favour because we haven't actually been mobilising. So anyway, as a result, we set up a petition and we set up a kind of a campaign on Instagram and Twitter. The amount of parents getting in touch, it's heartbreaking. Like, we've got messages from people saying, and from teachers as well, saying, thank you, I've got three kids here of my own and I'm trying my best, but it's really difficult for me to teach remotely. We've got messages from nurses saying, I'm worried about my kids. They're at home all day with, you know, I know they're not, they're, you know, with their, whoever they're with can't, maybe has their own job to do, or, you know, it's just, there's so many complicated situations. And you know what, Wendy, I think the real problem kind of stems from a flaw in our approach. We've had a very blunt approach to the school closure. So there was no recognition that essential workers' kids should be going in, and very disadvantaged kids, such as on, you know, kids on social worker lists or kids in, there was a Good Irish Times article today and they were talking about this, there was a Ballymun school completion programme to kind of aimed at kids who are at risk of leaving school early. Like, all those kids, they should, and the special schools, obviously, that goes without saying, like, all those, that community should never have been at home. So that's about, in the UK, I think it was about 15%, 20% of the school population were always going in. So we never had that. And as a result, I think the pressure now has just become unbearable. It's like a pressure cooker, you know, because you've got, well, I know the special schools went back, but, you know, it's midterm again, they went back for 2 days. But, you know, it just feels like now we've come to the stage where the only solution is to have a firm plan to reopen the schools. You know, that's, it solves a lot of problems here.
One of the things I've seen on social media and through this campaign of trying to get the schools reopened is the reality that children make up 21% of the citizens of our country. But they, at the moment, and you're trying to change that with this particular petition, Mary, is they don't really have a voice. And is that fair?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I've just been just blown away by how quiet everyone has been. You know, if they, as you say, 21% of our population, and that, you know, we should have people front, right and centre. And they have started to speak up. And I know they, you know, people have been speaking up, but no one's been shouting. It's almost, I don't know, Wendy, it's a strange kind of phenomenon. It's like people are scared to stand up and say, this is not right, you know, this is not right. And but like, we know the government wants schools open. That's their top priority. We know that teachers want to go back to school. They feel a duty of care towards their students, and they you know, they know they should be back in school. But yes, for all this motivation, nothing concrete has. I know they're talking about it today, but like, I guess parents are just a bit anxious that it's going to go like it did with the special schools, as in there'll be announcements and then they'll fall through, and then before we know it, we're limping towards the end of March, then you've got the Easter holidays. Do you know the way? We're just anxious.
It's just dragging on and on, and it's frustrating, isn't it? I mentioned earlier about the HSE's own piece of research, which was looking at just the impact, and this was only up until, I think it was the start of January, so it wasn't even taken into account the last 5 weeks. And one of the it found things it could have impacts on even long-term earnings, and you couple that with there's been huge amounts of research done in the US, I think 90,000 students, which showed very low child-to-teacher transmission of the virus. And today, reported on the BBC's website, is talking about a study from Warwick in England where it showed that the reopening of schools didn't actually lead to an increase in the virus being transmitted, and actually led to a decrease in the number of teachers that were catching the virus. So is this type of research and evidence actually being taken on board?
Exactly. I mean, the evidence is basically saying that primary school in particular, there is very, very low risk there. With secondary school, there is a little bit more risk. But, I mean, the risk to keeping the schools closed is, that's the unsafe decision, you know. And, I mean, there's things you can do to mitigate that. You know, there's some interesting research that shows that a lot of infection in schools is through the adults. It's the staff room, you know. So, like in my creche, where my little one goes, the teachers there have a test every Sunday. They all go in and have a test every Sunday. I think they're trying to change that to Monday morning now, so they don't have to go in on their day off. But could schools do that? That would be a bit of, you know, reassurance for teachers if they could.
Yeah, these rapid antigen tests, and I've heard of that as well. Lots of creches doing it because it's their business. They want to keep the door open and to support the families like yours, Mary. And today there was an article about people who are truck workers, you know, driving across to France, and they have to get their antigen tests. So surely that's a workable solution. So tell us a little bit about one of the parts of this reopening the schools is to try and say that schools are an essential service, because of course essential services are open. Do you think it's kind of bizarre even at this point that we're even having to have this argument?
It is. I mean, you know, we know that government wants open schools. They keep telling us that. But yes, they're saying one thing, but the actions are saying another. Do you know, like, so we're going to have concrete, we think we're going to have concrete opening dates for construction before we have schools. And I really hope that doesn't happen. And this is the kind of the essence of our drive is to, so basically, yes, we do believe it's an essential service, but our petition is set up around that. We have got messages to say, look, your petition is sowing division between the unions and parents, and that is not our aim. Like, we really admire teachers. I think everyone admires teachers even more now after we've had to try it ourselves. But the thing is, what we can only go on what we see, and what we see is talks and plans and then falling through, and like, we don't know what to make of it. So we're just ploughing ahead with, look, guys, sort it out. You know, this is an all government response here, need. It's not just the Department of Education. Just make it happen. You know, give us a date. Let the primary schools all go back. I mean, we don't see, we've looked at all the evidence. We've got three paediatricians on our group, and we've combed through everything, and we cannot see why it would have to be a phased for primary schools.
That's especially frustrating, Mary, when you consider obviously primary school students are younger. It's especially for those who are trying to balance working from home and homeschooling. You know, they're not able to kind of self-educate, whereas an older secondary school student, it's perhaps if they have access to internet and a computer, can watch some classes. But, you know, for a child who's 5, 6, 7, that's very difficult, a very difficult ask.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I think we've come to the crunch point now where there's so much evidence to show that it's safe for these primary schools in particular to go back, like almost immediately. Like, Public Health England came out last week and said it was safe for primary schools to go back there. But they're having like a big bang opening where everyone goes back on the 8th of March. And I think now testing will be integral to their secondary school plan. So, you know, we just think, look, get a plan together, make it work.
And the government listening? I know one of the things you wrote about, Mary, was a report from the Royal College of Physicians just talking about the impacts of schools being closed.
Yes, absolutely. Like, that was really sobering reading. And there's been various other reports from the World Health Organization, the European Centre for Disease Control, that show, look, you know, the evidence is there that it's not... It is much more safe for these kids to be in school than to be at home. I don't know if they're listening, Wendy, to be honest with you. I mean, they get back to us, we write to them. Actually, if anyone wants to get involved, if any parent at home is listening to this thinking, actually, do you know what? I think I might, I would like to get my voice heard. We have reopened schools IRL in real life, and we're on Twitter, on Instagram. Send us a message, contact us. We have a template there for writing to your TD. We have written to many TDs. They are getting back to us. They are telling us that we are working on it. It's on the table, you know. But yes, until we have a firm date, that's all we want. You know, like, we're not a political group. We're just a group of concerned parents who are worried about our kids. And we've just come to the end of the road where we think, look, you know, there's no excuse anymore. And this can't be a lever to pull against COVID anymore, the schools. Because it causes too much damage. And like you said, Wendy, at the start, like, kids are 21% of our population. But yes, there's many kids. I mean, our group kind of, we have the wherewithal. We know how to get our TD's attention, you know. But there's lots of kids that voices are not being amplified. So we just wanted to...
Well, Mary, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about the campaign and for the conversations you've been having through your work as a journalist as well. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming days and if we are given a date and an announcement. Thanks for joining us, Mary McCarthy, on Spirit Radio today.
Wendy, thank you so much, and we live in hope.
Very good. And as Mary mentioned there, if you want to get involved with that campaign, you're interested in finding out more about it, you might want to sign the petition. You can check out all their social media channels, which is Reopen Schools IRL, and there you'll find them on Instagram and Twitter, all that sort of stuff, and you'll see the petition. You can read it and decide if it's something you feel that you want to put your name to.
Spirit.
I've already seen pictures of some very organised friends who've already got their pancakes made. It's going to be dinner time pancakes in our house for us today. But it's nice to do something different, isn't it? And to think of just different ingredients that we can be creative with. And on the line to give us some ideas, we've Holly White, who's a food blogger and author of Veganish, with a plant-based cookbook, and she's going to be giving us some inspiration today. Thanks for joining us on the show, Holly.
Hi, good morning.
Okay, so have you made your pancakes yet, or are you planning to do it later on?
I actually did a whole like pancake masterclass last week, so I've had a week's prep on this.
So you're now the pancake master. If you've done the masterclass, that makes you the pancake master.
Yeah, well, because I have, I eat a vegan diet, and I also kind of try and focus on gluten-free options as well. And in kind of searching for things that worked for me, I found myself studying and training abroad, and I'm certified in plant-based nutrition. But also, I developed an online group to share these recipes. So I kind of last week did a sweet option and also a savory option. And the sweet one used ground up oats, which a lot of people kind of have in their cupboards as well, because it's about what's practical and what's easy.
Yeah, so you don't have to be going and having to like restock your food cupboard. So a lot of people, Holly, might just be trying a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet. Or for some people, they might have allergies in their house. A lot of kids, for example, get eczema when they have too much dairy, or it can flare up asthma sometimes for some people. So they might just say, you know what, I want to try and substitute some dairy products. So what substitutes can you use for things like milk and eggs?
Well, first of all, in terms of milk, what's amazing is that there's so many plant-based options. And I think you only need to go into your local supermarket and you will see a wall of whether it is oat, coconut, hemp, rice, soy. There's so many different varieties. And the great thing is that even now I find that people are kind of interested in trying, like going into your local barista and maybe just try an oat latte or an almond latte, or it's a great way of dipping your toe in and seeing what kind of milks do you maybe want to try. And I find they actually work as an even swap. However, what you mentioned about eggs is quite tricky. Eggs are not an easy thing to swap in vegan recipes, but there's a few things that I use, one of which is chia seeds, which you might kind of see in a health food store. But what is amazing about chia seeds is when you add them to water, they basically soak up moisture and form like a jelly-like consistency that helps bind. So
do you have to kind of soak them overnight, or how long do you have to soak them for, Holly?
5-10 minutes. And what you do is you need a ratio of 1-3. So 1 tablespoon of chia seeds to 3 tablespoons of water. Just put it in a little bowl, set it aside for 5-10 minutes, and then you can substitute that for an egg in a recipe. And another recipe that I have for pancakes uses mashed banana. And again, that helps bind, and it just adds a little bit of natural sweetness as well.
Okay, and they're both quite healthy as well. Actually, you can get the chia seeds. I know that I've gotten them in Lidl and Aldi as well, so they are quite accessible. It's great that there's products like that that are much easier to get than they might have been a few years ago.
Oh my God, tell me about it. Like, years and years ago, I remember going into health food stores and asking them to order things in, and exactly as you said, it's just amazing, especially the bigger supermarkets. They'll typically have, you know, an area dedicated to whether it's gluten-free options or, as you said, also plant-based as well, which is just, it's so exciting because for me, no one in my family is vegan whatsoever, but we all enjoy tasty food. And I just love the idea of everyone's needs being met. It's not about this or that. It's why shouldn't everyone be happy? And exactly as you said, some people, you know, have allergies. I'm lucky enough that I eat this way by choice, but I still feel that, you know, everyone's needs should be met around the table.
Yeah, that no matter what people's food choices are, that they'll still enjoy it. So what's the kind of basic way then? What are the kind of quantities and stuff to make a good pancake batter with the things that you've described with your chia seeds and all that sort of stuff? What else do you use?
Well, in my cookbook, as you mentioned, Veganish, I have a recipe in there for, it's a real classic, kind of like, as I said, it uses oats as a base, and then I use coconut milk, bananas, chia seeds, and then just blend it all up. And definitely if people are into a lot of fitness or training, you could also add some vegan protein powder to that as well. And what's brilliant about this is your batter actually gets better if you make it the night before. So literally throw it together in the Nutribullet the night before. As soon as you wake up, it can go straight into the pan. I like to use a little bit of coconut oil, fry it 2-3 minutes on each side. And how you know when to turn it is once the bubbles start to come through, that's when it's right. Flip it over, and even if you want, you could also add in some fruit or some berries at that stage. And then as you kind of bite into your pancakes, you'll get that lovely kind of fruity tang as well.
And you mentioned, Holly, you know, that obviously different people in your family, they have different diets and they're not all necessarily vegan. But when they've tasted your pancakes and they compare them to their traditional pancake, what's the reaction been?
You know, exactly as you said, they all... You know, no one would want to identify as vegan, but they respect meat. But the key thing is if food is tasty, everyone is happy. But that said, I do find a lot of people go, God, I'm surprised. I feel satisfied, but I don't feel weighed down. I feel, you know, lighter as well. And especially if ever I have, in previous times, friends over for dinner, it's always lovely to kind of go to a bit of an effort. But I always look at the reaction, and most of the time, pretty much everyone says, you know, I didn't miss the meat, but I'm delighted with how I feel. I feel satisfied, but I don't feel kind of stuffed, or, you know, I feel light as well.
And what about toppings then? What will you be putting on your pancakes? Give us some maybe savoury inspiration and some sweet inspiration as well.
Oh my God. Okay. In terms of savoury inspiration, I love simple things like just toasted flaked almonds are really, really delicious, and they add kind of a nice bit of crunch. In terms of sweet options, one thing that's really quick, and it's a very useful way if people have any fruit that's about to turn, is if you just place it in a pot and simmer it with a couple of tablespoons of water and a little bit of maple syrup, and then you'll make this gorgeous kind of coulis, and that'll last in your fridge for 2 or 3 days. So if you have fruit or berries that are just about to turn, you can, as I said, just simmer it up. And, you know, if you are serving it to kids, you could put it through a strainer just to get rid of any seeds, or else you could blend it to make it just like a more of a kind of a runny kind of a coulis. And something like that, or even just classic maple syrup, is so good.
And I love the idea of making the coulis out of fruit that's about to turn, because it will reduce your food waste because you'll eat it instead. Do you find, Holly, when you've been doing your Zoom cook-alongs, is it like parents with kids or individuals? Who's been getting involved?
It's exactly that. And I was amazed in the first week. I ran a whole Veganuary course. So it was every Monday night at 7 p.m. we all cooked together, and people had the recipes and they all cooked along. And I'm used to kind of doing TV demonstrations where you have like 4 or 5 minutes and you just do everything really quick. But I really realized if people are cooking a along at home, live. You know, do it slow, let everyone enjoy. And it also means that the time is kind of more practically spent, because in watching the Zoom at 7 p.m, by the end of it, you've your dinner cooked as well. And I think with lockdown on, we're all looking for different ways to kind of creatively spend our time. And cooking is like something I'm obviously hugely passionate about, but I think definitely when people are looking at healthy options or vegan options, it can seem really overwhelming. And what I love to do is just break it down and, as we're going, answer people's questions. And exactly as you said, I find there's so many mums and daughters, maybe they're interested in having a meat-free Monday, maybe they want to go more plant-based, or actually maybe they just want something fun to do on a Monday night.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? It's something we certainly try in our house. While we're not a vegetarian or vegan house, we love having nights that are meat-free. And I think a lot of people are moving towards that, where they want to have certainly a day or two where there's more veg and less meat. What about any upcoming Zoom cook-alongs, Holly? Is there any on the way?
Yeah, so I have a membership on my website. So basically people can sign up, and it's every second Monday at 7 p.m. and I email the recipes before. And we cook along, and it's very interactive. Like last week at the end of it, we were all kind of showing our different creations and we chat. And also if someone says something like, listen, I couldn't find this in my local supermarket, it's lovely because other people chime in and say, actually, Aldi has
that. Yeah, it's kind of it's a chat as well. It's not just like watching a YouTube video because it's interactive.
It's all bringing us all together. But for me, it's to really empower people in a practical way. Cause I think we've all bought books, or we've all kind of read recipes or watched videos online and said, that's lovely, and then forgotten totally about it. Whereas I do think kind of having the accountability of the class there means you actually do cook. And especially if people are kind of adjusting to a more plant-based option, you have to work a little bit harder in terms of how are you going to get your flavor? Are there any nutrients that you're missing out on? And that's the journey that I want to try and shorten for people. It took me 7 years to come to grips with it. If I can, you know, in a couple of hours a week, kind of make it a bit easier for someone, then I've done my job.
Yeah, it sounds great. Holly, thanks for joining us on the show today. That was Holly White, food blogger and author of Veganish. And as Holly was mentioning there, she's doing a meat-free Monday Zoom cook-along. It's every 2 weeks. And you can get the details of how you can sign up to those classes on her website, which is holly.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie. Yeah.